From the Fleet Defender Studios, this is Kill Chain, a platform cybersecurity and technology podcast. I'm Marcus Q, and I'm here with Kendall Bricko.
Hey, guys.
And Terry Reiner.
Hello, everybody.
All right. Today, we're going to be talking about simple cybersecurity strategies for small businesses. I know I've spent a lot of years in small businesses, and one of the things that's always a struggle is prioritizing cybersecurity. It can be one of those things that's expensive or, you know, you think definitely as a small business, oh, it can't happen to me. But as we've seen in the news and especially over the last year, small businesses actually are a pretty big target because they don't focus on cybersecurity. You know, bad actors are getting smarter. They know who to go after because they don't have these large systems in place.
Or not just that they don't focus on it, that they just can't afford it.
Yeah, you're right. I know in the past few years, like cybersecurity stuff has definitely gotten cheaper, but I don't know that everybody knows that, right? I mean, I think about password managers. Password managers now are something like $20 a month for 10 people. One password you can get for like 20 bucks a month, as low as that.
Yeah, there's a lot of tools that do make it cheaper. But there's also still a ton of companies out there that are trying to sell you everything under the moon. I mean, I've seen like a company that has 3 employees and they were, you know, they're trying to be sold on like all these VPN packages and all this like heavy lift stuff that you would normally see at like a 30 to 50 person company. And so I think there's like some really low cost, you know, tips and strategies that you can put in place for small businesses that don't break the bank, that make a huge difference.
But the problem is, you reach out to these companies to inquire about one product, and kind of like you're saying, they're trying to sell you every single thing. So they're like, yes, here's one cost-effective thing, or you can get this package that's 10 times what you were originally trying to spend.
Yeah, they're really good at upselling you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, until your 3-person company is spending $1,000 a month on VPNs and password management and everything.
No, it's $1,000 per person per month.
Yeah, and there's another part to this, which we'll get into today, which is really like the human management piece. I know, you know, since joining Fleet Defender and being a part of this crew, which is a very cybersecurity focused crew, you know, I've learned a lot about the social engineering aspects, a lot of the things that you can do just as a human being to better protect your passwords, your websites, your everything. So we'll get into some of that today too.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely a lot of different parts of the equation. I think I've even used some of these words on previous podcasts, but you've got the hardware, you've got the software, and then you've got the wetware. The wetware being the humans. And a sound cybersecurity strategy has to include all of them.
Where I want to start us today is really talking about the overall concept of these strategies, which Terry, I know you've mentioned a number of times, which is called defense in depth. And so maybe you can take, 30 seconds to explain to us, what does defense in depth really mean?
Right, absolutely. So here's a perfect analogy for you. You live in a gated community, and then you have a lock on your fence, and then you have a lock on your front door, and then you have a lock on your bedroom, and then you have a lock on the safe that's in your bedroom. That's defense in depth. Right? Like the attacker has to go through multiple different layers of security in order to get to what they're trying to get to. And you don't use the same lock. You know, you don't use the same garage door opener or the same brand or the same this or same that. That way, every single stage of or every single layer of defense, they have to do a lot of work to get through it. And the idea is now you add a camera at your gated community. And then you add a camera at your fence, and then you add a camera at your front door, and then you add a camera inside your house. And so not only are you trying to stop them, but you have a detection mechanism to see if they're trying to get through it. So it's kind of a two-stage, right? Like slow them down, but also be able to monitor to see if they're trying to get through it or if they did get through it.
So with the different layers of security, does one layer need to be more secured or harder to get through than the other? Or how do you kind of balance where the security of it?
It really depends on what you're protecting. If I'm trying to protect my bicycle, I'll put that inside of a garage behind a garage door opener. And there could be attacks, right? Like they could break in the window. They could spoof an RF signal or radio frequency signal, my little garage door clicker, and get it to open. And then they could steal my bike. I'm not going to keep my wife's expensive jewelry in the garage next to my bike, right? Then like what they could steal, the value is so high, I'm going to actually spend more money to protect that. And that's when it goes in the safe that I have buried well deep in my house behind multiple layers of locks and stuff. And that's where the crown jewels are going to reside, right? And so it's really what you're protecting. And you got to know what the value of that information is, right? Like if it's just a list of your employees, not that big of a deal. If it's a list of your employees, their birth dates, their social security numbers, their, you know, that type of information, then you should spend more to protect that because obviously that's more valuable information.
And so before we jump into the strategies here, which we'll do in a second, the one other thing I wanted to cover was what you mentioned with what I believe today are called intrusion detection systems. So the camera on the gate. Have you seen those as being something that has come about more in the recent years? Or is that something that's always been there but is getting more affordable for people?
It's always been there, and I think it's just getting more affordable. And also the way that they're, you know, the technology itself is evolving as well because – you know, for example, a lot of people are moving to the cloud and they're keeping data in the cloud. And so that's a completely different environment than if you had on-premise equipment. And so it's just a different layers, I guess. But we've had intrusion detection systems for many years. They've just had to continue to evolve to one, cover usage in terms of like, where are we putting data? Where are we putting our systems and how are we computing? But also evolving with the attacks to stay ahead of them as well.
Yeah, great. Well, let's actually jump into some strategies here. So the first one I want to talk about is really a human component. And that is, you know, assigning somebody in the organization to take accountability for cybersecurity. So, you know, I think there's a classic psychological study in the past where it's, you know, if somebody's on the street yelling help and everybody's looking out their window watching this person yell for help, nobody will go and help. Or it's the same reason why in CPR classes, they say, point to one specific person and say, you call 911. Because if everybody thinks that everybody else is going to do something about it, nobody acts. And so assigning a specific person, and it doesn't even have to be an IT person, who has the backing of leadership to take accountability for cybersecurity can make a huge difference in an organization.
I agree. And they would track everything, right? So if you have a firewall or if you don't have a firewall, that person could tell you. If you have a training program or don't have a training program, or how often do people need to be trained, et cetera, that would be the person that's going to be accountable to make sure all that happens.
Yeah, a good example of a non-IT person, you know, looking at cybersecurity, actually, you know, kind of bringing it back to Fleet Defender for a second. You know, of course, we talk with CISOs and CIOs, but people who are actually really interested in what we're doing too are fleet managers. You know, or maintenance managers even, who are looking for, you know, some intrusion detection system like we make. And so that's where you start to see cybersecurity bleed into other areas where people might not be speaking the same words around cybersecurity, but are saying, I want to protect this thing, you know, whatever it might be. They're saying, well, I want some kind of safeguard for this. And, you know, we might go, oh, that's an intrusion detection system.
Right. They might not even know, like you said, what that is. Like they can't say like the words intrusion detection system because they're not a cyber person or they don't, you know, have awareness of what that exactly means. But they look at a newspaper heading and they're like, oh, that got hacked. Well, what if we get hacked? And then they just have enough to know, like, we should have something in place for this. Who do I talk to in order to get help that happen?
Yep. And that's where Google AdWords are still alive.
Yeah. And with that, talking to people that don't necessarily have the background or anything, one of the biggest things that people can do is train their employees, make them aware of all the different kind of cyber threats, cyber tactics that are out there, because human error is one of the biggest things of why a business does get hacked.
You know, you stole my thunder. I was waiting for someone to say, like, what is the number one thing you could do? If you could only do one thing. And that's it. Just one thing. What would it be? And my answer is always train your employees. Because honestly, you know, from decades of experience in cyber exploitation and hacking and everything, I could say that going after wetware or going after the humans is the cheapest, the fastest, and the easiest. I mean, hands down. And so, you know, if I can get somebody to click on a link that loads malicious code on their computer, That is way easier than spending months doing extensive testing and reverse engineering to find a vulnerability that I can then write an exploit for in order to get into that system. And so people are critical.
Yeah, I think that's where you see like all these ransomware attacks, you know, ransomware all over the news. A lot of that starts with clicking a link in an email or phishing, as it's called. It's pretty amazing, too, that we all still think of, you know, these different hacks or exploits or scams that are coming at us probably a few years in the past, right? Like there's always new evolving methods. There's new ways of getting people to do things or social engineering that are always coming out that are new. I know, you know, one thing I hadn't experienced until maybe last year was getting an email from, you know, somebody in my company, and it was the exact email address, right? But like the, instead of an L, it was a capital I. And it's like, I would not have even thought of that. You know, it's like they're getting better and better every day.
Right. Absolutely. And just so in case anybody's not aware, you mentioned the word phishing, you know, and that's P-H, not F, you know, phishing. And that is where someone's crafting an email that looks legitimate and they're trying to get you to take some action, but it's actually not a legitimate email. And it's funny because I get messages all the time from all of our employees that are like, hey, did you send me an email asking for this? No, I didn't. You know, like send me your phone number. I'm in a meeting and I need your phone number. Like I already have everybody's number. So clearly that's, you know, it's good to question and be skeptical of anything that comes in over email, because by nature, email is not a secure communication mechanism.
Yeah. I got to imagine it's almost like they're doing exploitation in depth. Because you get an email asking for a phone number, and let's say I reply to that email and give them my phone number, why? Right? I mean, I know then a text message starts, but where there's got to be a chain there that they know, like, all right, an email to get a phone number. I can get a phone number. And then what do they do with that phone number?
Yeah, it's just a kill chain. And so it's the cyber kill chain. And, you know, and they just walk you through each process. And different attack vectors require different information and things like that. And I mean, some of it could be like, just give me your phone number and then they're going to go sell your information. But then other ones, like you said, that's where the text messages could start. And they're going to use multiple different avenues to kind of hit you at the same time from multiple vectors to try to get what they're getting after, you know, to try to get the information or the access or whatever that they need from you. And there's been a few, and you know, ChatGPT and some of this generative AI systems, there's a lot of news articles out there right now about how they think that is going to allow attackers to create more legitimate looking emails and increase the game even further.
Wow. So with phishing being such a big issue nowadays, and we're talking about, you know, Terry, your one thing would be, you know, train employees. I believe there's a lot of different phishing training out there. And I think even a lot of free phishing training to, you know, train your employees on how to spot phishing emails, you know, how to adopt a more zero trust policy. I think there's a lot of those out there now.
There is. And, you know, the Small Business Administration, both at the federal level, at the state level, there are a lot of organizations out there that are putting out free information and free training to help small businesses. So if you're a small business and you're really interested in doing this, you know, start looking for resources or even just reach out to us and we'd be happy to point you in the right direction. But there's a lot of free training out there.
Yeah, I just went through some phishing training not too long ago, and one good site that's a government site is the CDSE, where they have a whole bunch of different type of cybersecurity training, PII training on how to keep it secure, and just a whole variety of that. So that's one that I would recommend looking at.
Right. Yeah. And again, like as people who go through this, and I mean, we have mandated cybersecurity training for all employees for both commercial reasons and government reasons. If you need help, just reach out to us and we'll happy to point you in the right direction and help you find the resources that you need.
Yeah. So the next strategy I'm going to take us into is a pretty simple one, and it's staying current on new patches for, you know, Windows, Apple, whatever system you're using. And I know that I've had an iOS update sitting on my phone before for, you know, 2 weeks. And then you read about how, oh, Apple had 2 zero-day vulnerabilities. And it's like, oh no, I should have updated that right away. That's why they push those updates. And that's why you have to install those updates when you get the notice, even though it's inconvenient. It's so important to, you know, push those updates through for that reason.
Right. I mean, if someone told you that if you walk down the street and you're wearing a blue shirt, you're going to be robbed, would you still walk down the street, or would you go change your shirt and wear a different color shirt that's not blue? I mean, if everyone in a blue shirt's getting robbed, the first thing I'm going to do is make sure I'm not wearing a blue shirt.
All right. The next one then. Restricting Wi-Fi access with a strong password and have only those who need it have that access to the network. That gets into really also creating a public Wi-Fi that you can share out. So I know, you know, you walk into a coffee shop, a Target or whatever, and you always see kind of like Target Wi-Fi and then Target Wi-Fi guest or public. And the reason for that is you don't want somebody who shouldn't have full-time access to your Wi-Fi network to have full-time access. And maybe we can dive into a little bit of why that is. Why does that matter? Why even have a guest network?
That's a great question. There's a couple of things to unpack with that one. But first, I would recommend not naming your network Target or Walmart or Fleet Defender, because then anybody knows exactly what network they're going after. So, you know, I have a practice at the companies that I've been a part of that I don't name my Wi-Fi networks after my company name or anything that's identifiable. And I also don't use like Target and then Target guest. I would use, I'm going to make this up, but like monitor and mouse, where monitor would be my, you know, company Wi-Fi and mouse would be my guest Wi-Fi, because you don't want to make it easy for them. Like if they're going to spend all their time trying to break into your guest network, well, so be it. They, you know, gets good. But from an attacker perspective, when you name it guest, I know I'm not interested in that. And the reason is, like you said, behind the scenes, there's what they call VLANs or virtual LANs, and they basically isolate the guest Wi-Fi from the rest of the computers on your network. So, for example, if I connect to Target's Wi-Fi, like I'm making this part up, but this is just a good example since you brought it up, their main Wi-Fi, like that's probably where all their business computers are on. Maybe their point of sale terminals are on, like all the really good stuff, you know, is on that network. Their guest network can't access any of those computers. Like it is completely segregated through the use of VLANs to where if you connect your phone to that, yes, you can get to the internet, but no, you cannot get to all their workstations, to their point of sale terminals and things like that. And so that's why you always divide that off all the way up to like good security practices for your own home. You know, even just normal routers that come from your Spectrum, Cox, AT&T, whoever, they will allow you to set up a guest network and a non-guest network. And like the SSIDs, you can set them separately and everything else. So that way, you know that if, say, your daughter's friend comes over and they connect their phone to your Wi-Fi, they're connecting to your guest network. They can't get to your business machine or to your printer or to the, any of the other stuff.
And so you're saying even in a home Wi-Fi network that it still uses that VLAN, that is that virtual local area network?
Yep. Virtual net. Yep.
Interesting. I don't know why I thought that would be only for businesses, but it makes sense. Why not for home too? Yeah.
Well, the technology is just built right into all the routers today. Like that's just common practice. So any of the routers that you get, like even for example, I just got a new internet service at my house. And in the setup process of the hardware, it walks you through and it lets you say like, okay, here's my Wi-Fi network. And then here's the guest network. And you can even do other things too. Like you can limit the bandwidth usage on a guest network. So if someone's trying to like download a huge file, it's not going to crash all your other machines or slow down your TV streaming or whatever else.
So say somebody does get into your network and they manage to corrupt files or mess up your system, backups would be a good way to fix or replace those, correct?
Well, of course, like you should always have a backup system in place. I mean, that's, you know, like ransomware can get in, encrypt all your files, lock stuff down. And if you don't have a backup, then you're at their mercy, like you're stuck. Yeah. And so when it comes to backups, there's actually this like famous rule. It's called the 3-2-1 rule. And basically what that says is you should have 3 copies of all your data on 2 different media, one being offsite. And so that way you have multiple copies of your data. They're spread out on different media. There's one offsite. So that way, if your building burns down or there's a flood or whatever else, like that one offsite backup that you have, that's going to be your saving grace.
And so we talk about an offsite backup. I would imagine a cloud system would be an offsite backup, right? Because you're using AWS or Google or whatever. It's not on site. So if you just use cloud, would that be enough? Or would you still want a secondary backup?
You can use the cloud, and the cloud is good. But what you want to make sure of is that it's not corruptible. Meaning if I can write to it, once I get into your systems, I can just jump to your cloud backup and I can erase those or corrupt those as well. And that's happened. Like, that's a real thing. And so that's why you want to make sure, like really secure data, people will still write that to a hard drive and stick it in a safe, like a USB, you know, thumb drive or a hard drive, or even like maybe even magnetic tape reels. Those still exist today, believe it or not. They still do magnetic tape reels on some places.
Wow.
But yeah, you want to make sure one is not just offsite, but offline, one that's not corruptible.
Got it. And so would that be getting into like a write-only or read-only drive where you can only push content to it and can't pull stuff out of it?
Yeah, once you write to a certain area, then that's locked down.
Interesting.
So that way it's not corruptible. So yeah, but I mean, we're starting to get into, you know, some really interesting scalable issues, right? Like you can scale that. Like you can set up this really fancy backup in the cloud using like a technology called Veeam, and like you could do all this stuff. But if you're like a three-person company, and again, small business, like that might still be overkill. And that's why I brought up, you know, that removable hard drive. I've got a 4 terabyte hard drive that's USB, and then I'll back stuff up to, and then I'll unplug it and stick it in the safe. And I know that no one can get to it because I'm the only one with the combination, at least not easily. And if we ever have an issue, I can just pop that out and say, okay, here's our data from the date that I last backed it up, kind of a thing. And so having something offline is really good. So if you're a small business, you know, maybe that thumb drive with your most important data on it is good if you're like just a few people. But as you start to grow, you're going to make sure you're going to want to have help. So you still probably can't afford a full-time IT person when you've only got like 5-6 people. And that's where having like a MSP, like an internet or a security provider, that's where they can help you out, to where you just use them when you need them and they can help set stuff up and get it moving.
Sure. So small business kind of starting at the level of, you know, using OneDrive or SharePoint or, you know, Google Cloud with a physical backup of a multiple terabyte hard drive, which maybe costs, I don't know, $200. The price seems to constantly fall. And so starting there, and then from there, you know, keeping with your original cloud system and then getting an MSP to help with those backups. And then once you grow from there, it gets, you know, even more expanded. But at that point, that MSP can really support you.
Right, exactly. And I mean, it's as a business owner, you know, you understand scaling, right? And so you know that you have so much revenue or so many shifts, whatever, you have so many people. But then if you win this other contract, you need 5 more people, or you need this more people. So you got to start scaling your business. Cybersecurity is exactly the same way, right? Like you've got just a few people, you have a small policy, a cybersecurity policy, with your procedures and everything else outlined. And this is how we do things. We just back up on a thumb drive that goes in the safe. But then as you grow the business and as you scale, then of course your cybersecurity has to scale with it.
Yeah. And I think we're talking about as you scale, right? As adding new employees, for anyone out there who has a 3-person company, you know, those 3 people are really doing everything. But as you hit 5 and then 10 and then 15 and then 30, you know, as you scale outward, you have more people with access to this important information. And I think that's where we get into segmenting and limiting access. So really giving people only the access they need to do their job. And I think that's hard in a small business environment because, you know, people are thinking, you know, well, everybody does everything. But how can you really segment those business divisions to limit that access? Because there is stuff that even in a small team, you know, a team of 10, you still need to limit access.
Right. And that'd be called access of least privilege. And so basically what that means is that as our marketing and sales director, you only have access to the information that you need. Like, there's no reason why you should have access to all of our engineering designs, right? Like, it's outside of the scope of your job. You should never actually need access to that information. And so that's where you just make very smart choices of only giving people access to where they need. I worked for a company as an intern. This is a very long time ago. And day one of my internship, I had full access to every code repository they had. And that was really bad from a security perspective, right? Because I'm an intern. They don't know me. Like, I'm a complete unknown. And yet I could download all the source code across all their product lines.
They really believed in you.
Probably not a good idea.
They really did.
Yeah. I must have been a very trusting.
Yeah.
Oh, he's trustable.
Yeah.
Totally trustable. I shouldn't tell him what I used to do as a kid, but no. So these are all really good strategies for a small business. But I mean, ultimately, what you really need is a plan, right? Because if you don't have a plan, then you're just going to do things that you think is right, but might not be right. Or you're going to spend money putting things in that someone's trying to sell you, but might not be the best idea. And so that's where having a security plan to guide you in everything that you're doing is going to be pretty critical. And so, again, if anybody needs help with, like, how do we put a plan together? How do we actually design out this so that way we're spending money in the right way or we're implementing the right things? Again, just reach out to us. Go to fleetdefender.com. The contact us page has a form you can fill out and just throw on there, you know, like security plan help or whatever else. And we'll, you know, we'll at least give you some ideas. And if not, then we can at least point you in the right direction to get you the help that you need.
Right. Because even a company that's just starting, you know, there's so many free resources, right? I mean, there's a ton of free resources that you can use to get started today. You know, we talk about some of the free online phishing trainings, even using like a Chrome password manager that's free in there. Like, there are things to do randomly generated passwords for free. So there's a lot of different free tools to get started now. And then as you start growing, you know, moving into some of those, you know, less expensive tools and until you get to the level of needing an MSP.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Perfect. Well, gang, thanks for joining today. And if you have any questions about, you know, your small business cybersecurity or just need help finding some different resources, definitely reach out to us on our contact page at fleetdefender.com. But otherwise, Terry, Kendall, thank you for joining today.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we'll see you next time.
See you next week.